Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We are going to begin today handling briefly Senate Bill 59. And they forgot to give us our script, Representative Ackerman, but let's see if we can do it solo. Representative Ackerman has moved that the committee reconsider the vote by which it passed Senate Bill 59 to the floor. Is there any objection to Representative Ackerman's motion on reconsidering that vote? Hearing none, the vote is reconsidered.
But that's more than taking words out of my mouth.
Yeah, you did a nice job too with it,
Thank
Bob. That was
sure.
Well handled.
You make me look good.
Okay, now we have Senate Bill 59 back in front of us, committee, and I'll open a work session. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The A6 amendments are before you, and they are, there's also a hand-engrossed copy. Basically, the change, we're going to go with the amendments that would have left. Again, we're talking about criminal forfeiture of deadly weapons, which would be firearm or other deadly weapon. And the change that this would do is when that deadly weapon is sold, how would the proceeds be used? And what we did is, if you look at this, we would be following the structure that was built last session on Chapter 666, 2001, so that the proceeds, for lack of a better word, would be divvied up among the parties that were to be that it would have been divvied up with in the Chapter 666 from last session. And then if you look at Section 4 of the bill, this is the section that becomes operative when 666 goes away in 05. And what Ms. Vanderbilt and myself try to do is be faithful to the split of the money between law enforcement and the asset forfeiture and illegal drug cleanup fund. However, one of the pots of money or one of the accounts goes away, so we substituted in on page 5, line 19, the mental health, alcoholism, and drug services account. This is the DHS account that is to have money used for drug services. That money for that account is then split into 40% for local county drug services, 40% for state matching funds, and 20% for incarcerated persons' drug services. This was the what Ms. Vanderbilt and I thought was the best replacement for what is found in the Chapter 16 and 17, which goes away. To be faithful to those sections of 2001, Chapter 666.
Okay. Helpful. Representative Brzezinski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This Dash 6 is actually kind of a blending of the Dash 5s that Representative Jensen had brought forward, that it will, in fact, allow law enforcement to actually sell the weapons that come in their possession at their prerogative. But it also stays true to the, I believe, the intent of the voters when they passed Measure 3, which was the civil forfeiture. And then in 2001, when the body actually adopted a new forfeiture procedure, which is criminal and in nature, and it allows and it mandates the same type of division of proceeds that has been agreed upon by this body in 2001. The other part of the bill that the current SB 59 does not have is an emergency clause. I find that to be very important because currently, if this bill as it is before us right now without the A6, it goes into effect. It would not go into effect until January of 04, and so we would not have a relief at the law enforcement level in being able to use this fix. And so the emergency clause will allow it to go into effect immediately upon signature of the governor, and we will have the same formula that is currently called for under criminal forfeiture, with the exception that one of those accounts will be is scheduled to sunset, so we've actually put it into another account that will serve the same purpose.
Okay. Representative Jensen, do you have anything to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I'm comfortable with the Dash 6 amendments. I think it is consistent with what we're doing, what we were doing last time. And I appreciate the chair's indulgence of bringing it back to committee. I appreciate the representative's indulgence in doing it this way rather than Representative Brzezinski's indulgence in doing it this way rather than other ways that might have been available or trying other ways that might have been available to him. So.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a motion to move the Dash A6 amendments. All right, good. Thank you, Representative Jensen. Representative Jensen moves the Dash A6 amendments to Senate Bill 59. Is there discussion on the motion, Representative Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. On page 2, lines 5 and 6, it says, when a weapon is sold pursuant to this subsection, the law enforcement agency shall pay the proceeds from the sale, less the cost of the sale is provided in Section 16 and 17, Chapter 666 of Oregon Laws 2001. I was under the impression, maybe wrongfully, that the purpose of allowing the agency to sell the weapon was to retain those funds for use in their department.
Representative Brzezinski?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, it actually does allow for that. What it does, though, it puts it into the formula that was already agreed to by this legislature in 2001. Section 16 and 17 has a formula with a portion, I believe it's 40%, to go into law enforcement for their use at their discretion and their prerogative. But it stays true to the other components of part of it going into alcohol or drug treatment, as well as for other purposes, including the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Council. And there's a formula. And if you look at the, I guess it's on page...
I provided the 666.
Okay. And if you look on the bottom of page 2 and page 3 of the amendment, you can see how it has the breakout, 7% to the illegal drug cleanup fund, 10% to the general fund, 40% to mental health. And that's really trying to mirror what has been provided by council, what is already required under Chapter 666, Section 16 and 17 of the 2001 Act.
Okay, so if I may, Mr. Chair?
You may.
So that is further down then in capital A through capital E is reiterating what's in Chapter 16 and 17, or Section 16 and 17?
It is, with the exception that chapter 666 and then those sections will be sunsetted, I believe, in 05. And so what we attempted to do is to maintain that same continuity beyond 05.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So the motion is to adopt the A6 amendments. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? The A6s are adopted. Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 59 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves Senate Bill 59 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, Ann, call the roll.
Representative
Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Kamal? Aye.
Representative Pierce?
Aye.
Representative Pagosto?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
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 Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 59 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Jensen, I'm going to ask you to continue to carry the bill. Is that fine?
I think you'd be happy to, and now that I've maybe eliminated having to go one-on-one with an attorney in the floor, why?
Well, that's good. We'll have Representative Brzezinski speak to the bill as well on the floor,
okay,
if you would, sir.
Mr. Chair, before we move office, I do want to appreciate the chair being willing to allow us to bring this back and take care of it through the committee process and not on the floor.
Always prefer to avoid a minority report where at all possible. So, all right.
Let's hold hands.
Yeah, let's all, can we see? Well, we got a couple others still to go, so we're not holding hands yet. All right, we're going to now move to, if you thought that discussion was interesting, this next one will be a real barn burner. We're going to move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 297, and I'll open that public hearing now. And I'm looking at it always surprises me when I look at a witness list and people leave the top line blank because they're waiting for someone else to come in and say to fill it in to say they want to go first. Has everyone had a chance to sign up that wants to sign up on the witness list? Okay, so why don't we have the panel of proponents come forward first, if you would, please, on 297. And while you're getting ready, Council, do you want to just give us maybe just a brief
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 297 comes to you from the Committee on Judiciary and basically has two parts. The first part enacted the so-called Allsons method of allocation of insurance companies' duties to defend and indemnify insured for environmental pollution-related claims under certain circumstances. And then the second part of the bill basically sets forth the process and procedure for finding old policies, because many of these cases go back to the 50s and 60s, when the claims would have arisen from, and insurance policies dating back to those dates.
All right. And our who's going to lead off? Is that going to be you, Mr. Wyatt?
Yes.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bill Wyatt. I'm executive director of the Port of Portland, and I'm joined today by Tom Gallagher, who is representing Schnitzer Industries, and Mr. Chris Hermans, who's an attorney with Stoll Reeves and who represents the port on these matters. And I think that Mark Nelson will join us later. He's buzzing about the building on some other matters, so potentially in the middle of our testimony. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity. This is a very important measure to us, and I want to give you just some sense of history here before recognizing Mr. Gallagher. First, this comes to you, I think, with a strong endorsement from the other body, from the Senate, 27-3 vote, unanimous out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And it's supported as well by a coalition of interests, including the port, Schnitzer Industries, Northwest Natural Gas, and the Oregon Metals Council. And I think it is significant to note that all of the attention around this has tended to focus on the Superfund site, which we generally characterize as the lower Willamette Harbor area. But it has a potential application in over 500 sites around the state that are currently on DEQ's confirmed release list. So it has, I think, broad statewide implications. From our perspective, this is very significant because we are, along with others, involved in a process to clean up the lower Willamette Harbor area after a century of various industrial uses. Our goal is to do so in a timely fashion with sound environmental principles and in a fashion that leaves the port financially viable and competitive with other western ports, a subject I'll address in a moment. This is our front yard, essentially, and it is the principal seaport of Portland, and obviously we, many of us in this room, tie our history to these facilities. Every day, just about 40,000 Oregonians get up and go to family wage jobs because there is a seaport in Portland. Last year, about $14 billion worth of cargo flowed through our port. Now, insurance recovery is a very important part of this cleanup effort, and I can speak for the port in this regard. We really have two ways to cover the expenses associated with this cleanup. One is to recover on these policies for which premiums were paid over a long period of time. And the other, essentially, is to liquidate our marine terminals, which are our principal holdings. One of the choices that I'm sure will not be given by the EPA or the DEQ is do the best you can with what you got and walk away from the rest. The Lower Willamette is a Superfund site. It's on the list. It's going to be cleaned up, and we're going to do our part. It's never simple, of course. The port was created by this legislature back in 1891, I might add, to create a channel between the mouth of the Columbia River and Portland to a then depth of 25 feet. And back in 1971, the legislature merged the Port of Portland with the Portland Commission on Docks, which at that time owned and managed all of the marine terminals, the public marine terminals in Portland. They did so, obviously, to gain the efficiencies that these two organizations would bring together. We purchased and developed properties, constructed facilities such as the ship repair yard at Swan Island. We filled submersible land, and we built Liberty ships during the Second World War, where a very large part of the pollution owing to the Superfund site is located. And we've had a variety of general liability insurance policies over the years, and we'll end up negotiating with over a dozen carriers, and those negotiations are ongoing. Now, the provisions we're recommending through this measure will be of great assistance to us, and I'd like to just briefly touch on them. First, a subject area that is generally characterized as all sums. The port's general liability insurance policies say that each carrier will pay all sums the port to the port must pay due to property damage up to the policy limit. So one distinction, and I think it's a very important thing for you to understand, we're not here debating about whether or where the liability is. That is resolved through a separate process and is unaffected by this. The question is, once that matter is resolved, how do the various carriers resolve amongst themselves how to cover their share of that liability? Other states, notably, I might add, Washington, have addressed this allocation issue and established the all-sums rule as we have proposed in these amendments. An all-sums approach will make for a more efficient and less costly handling of claims by putting money into cleanups at the front end of the process. Taking such action benefits everyone in the state and falls within the proper role of the legislature. And I think, again, from our perspective, the importance here is this. We'd rather take every dollar that we're able to generate through various settlements and put it into cleaning up the challenges of the lower Willamette, as opposed to using it for litigation and attorney fees. And that's really part of our challenge and one of the reasons why we so strongly support this legislation. Let's take the money and use it for its intended purpose. And finally, this will speed the process of obtaining payment under policies providing coverage without ultimately increasing the final obligation of any carrier. Again, this is really not about who has liability and under what circumstances. That is either resolved or will be through a separate process. This is, once that is established, how do you resolve how the carriers deal with one another in the course of making payments? And finally, the other issue that I think is addressed here, and I know that Mr. Gallagher will be talking about this on behalf of Schnitzer, has to do with lost policies. Some of these policies are very old, and in the case of the port, we inherited these policies and these coverages, and not all of them are available. Some have been lost. In the state of Washington, the loss policy provision basically is handled after a series of acknowledgments are made that tends to indicate that coverage existed at the time. And so it's tough to be negotiating across the table from someone who may have your policy, who's reading your policy, and who won't share it with you. And so that as well is a very important aspect of this legislation. I think in just concluding, I want to say that we see this as very important in allowing us and our partners who are attempting to clean up the lower Willamette to move in as timely and efficient a fashion as possible. We've adopted a very aggressive schedule with the Environmental Protection Agency. Having the resources available in order to accomplish that are critically important. If we're able to settle as aggressively as we possibly can, we still won't have all of the resources that are required. So we have significant challenges ahead of us, but this will make a difference.
Thank you, Mr. Wyatt. Let's go to whoever wants to go next, and then we'll just have questions for the panel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher representing Schnitzer Investment Corporation, which is a development company, and Schnitzer Steel. Tom Zielenka did this testimony on the House side. I'm going to pass it out to you. I'm going to summarize pieces of it very quickly for you. First, I want to tell you that a little bit of the events that got us here. We introduced a very aggressive bill in the House that had six major areas that we wanted to deal with in terms of settling these insurance policies. In the House, we amended it to three. In the Senate, we reduced it to two. You have in front of you only two of the issues that we originally brought in. We amended it for many reasons. One, we listened to the objections from the other side, and we listened and talked with different members as to which pieces they understood, didn't understand. In the Senate, we benefited from the advice and counsel of the staff of this committee, especially Bill Joseph, who drafted some amendments that did some compromises on the allocation part that I think are very good public policy, and I'll get into the pieces of those as we go through this. But we have tried very hard to move this bill into a form in which we think that that it is now, and that it represents a very positive result for Oregon. One of the things that Tom would have said if he were here is to talk about Snitzer's and how long Snitzer has been a major corporation in Oregon. It started in Oregon. It's been in Oregon. It does its business in Oregon. It's a community leader in Oregon and involved in Oregon. Snitzer has signed up on the Lower Willamette Group as one of the 10 principally responsible parties to come forward. That's at great risk, because those people who sign on the dotted line are responsible under the environmental cleanup law for all of the cleanup. Joint and several liability applies to those people who have voluntarily come forward. That's one of the reasons why this is an especially important part for us, that we reduce as much as possible the issues, the litigation, and the complexity of settling with the insurance companies and moving the money forward. I'm going to talk about a couple of issues, a couple of cases that Tom has that will illustrate the two pieces of our bill, the allocation of the risk and the loss policies. We started our pursuit on recovering on the Moody property back in 1988. We finally went to court over the loss policies in the Moody case in 1995. We are still involved in appeals of that case. In this case, we didn't have the copies of the policies. We had pieces. We had the policy numbers. We had the amounts. We had the insurance company. We had a paper trail. The company said that if you don't have the policy, it's our burden to provide the policy, and without the policy, there's no coverage. The issue of coverage, without the policy, you don't have the insurance. One of the things that we've done in this bill is to put in place or draft language that puts in place the Washington loss policy provision, which was done by rule in the state of Washington. I'll jump ahead in this testimony to a case which we had in Washington that was similar to the one in Oregon. In Washington, we worked with the insurance company to get the quickest and most cost-effective way to resolve the claim. In Washington, we agreed with the insurance company on a settlement position that was the least cost to our company and to the insurance company, and avoided any litigation on the part with the Department of Environmental Ecology, and got us to the quickest possible remedial action. The same company in Oregon has refused to recognize our claim because of a loss policy. The point here, the process here, is not to make coverage for somebody that didn't have coverage under their claim. If there's a rider in the policy, if there's a provision in the policy that excludes environmental coverage, that prevails. If there is an issue of whether or not the pollution occurred during the course of their coverage, that is not covered by this bill. Once you have coverage, the issue is whether or not you can establish a policy was in place, and if so, what's the company involvement or liability is under that policy. In another case on allocation, on allocation of the settlement risks, we worked the case ourselves all the way through the process, and this is a piece of Portland property. We took a settlement, made a settlement in mediation with the EPA without the involvement of the insurance companies, without the insurance companies pro-offering a defense on this plan. And then when we went to settle with the insurance companies, having accepted liability coverage, the insurance companies had, but they hadn't come forward yet, we got into a great debate over the allocation, each insurance company saying, you have to collect from the other one before you collect from me. We still have not resolved that issue. Working on settlements with those insurance companies. None of them were willing to compromise, and none of them were willing to approve or pay until we collected from the others. So the allocation piece that we have in this policy is a combination of all sums and a bit of pro rata. We will go after a settlement with the insurance companies that we think have coverage. If we can find one of the insurance, make a settlement, then we're done. If we can't, then we will follow a process to pick one of the insurance companies to sue. And those insurance companies can bring in the other insurance companies and in a way of settling the risk. If you look at the bill, and I'm going to shift here a second to cover some of the amendments that we think would be helpful in this bill. But if you look at, on the bill on page 2, we talk about the basis for filing suit. And it's at the bottom of page 2. It says the insurer must choose the insurer based on one of the following factors: total time on the risk, policy limits, and the policy that provides the most important type of coverage. There's a factor D in there, any other factor that the insured considers appropriate. We've heard back from the insurance commissioner's office that in part the way this is written, it kind of trumps the other three. And we understand those claims. We're prepared to come forward in the work session with amendments that deal with section D, so that there is a very specific process of picking the insurance company to sue. There's another amendment that John DiLorenzo will bring forward, which we will agree with, and that's what happens to companies that are in the process of settling right now, that have settled with some companies, haven't settled with others. How should this new legislation apply to that? He will bring forward that amendment. There's another amendment which we support from DCBS, allowing them to do rulemaking on this part of the provision. That's a very helpful provision. It will eliminate, because this is in DEQ statute, it eliminates some DEQ problems, and it will allow them to go forward and draft rules that will make both of these provisions work better. There is one other provision in here, and that's on Section 3, where it says if the insured is self-insured or uninsured. And we are going to have to come forward with some clarifying language on that, language that will basically say if the insured chose not to purchase insurance, if the insured went bare, then that insured will pick up their allocated share of that risk. It's not our attempt to foist any of these costs off onto insurance companies, to get the insurance companies to act as banks, or the other objections that we've heard. It's our process here not to deal with forcing the insurance companies to have coverage. That it will be settled differently. All of those defenses are in place. But if they do have coverage, we want to get the settlement process moving forward. We want to assist in the settlements being done quickly and the money moving at the beginning of the process, not at the end. We want to get some better balance in this for the property owners, and we want to clean up the property in the state of Oregon that's contaminated right now. The last thing I'll say is we've done a number of pieces of legislation on industrial lands. Both in the Portland area and around the state. There are bills moving through the House and bills moving through the Senate on the economic development factors of cleaning up industrial land. The single biggest impediment to reusing existing industrial land is contamination. The only thing that removes that impediment to redeveloping that land is the cash to come forward and clean it up. The cash will come from one of three places. It will come from the party that's responsible for the contamination, and that's right and just, and that party will have to pay everything to clean up that land that they're able to do. The second point, we hope it will come from some of the insurance policies that were purchased in the past that do not have the pollution exclusion. And the only other place that it can come from is when those properties go bankrupt without cleanup, they become orphan sites and become paid for by the state of Oregon as some part of the economic development package eventually that we'll have to go forward with. So that's my testimony on that, and Mark Nelson from the Metals Council is tied up in another bill, and I did cover most of his points. So let me stop and take questions.
Thank you. Next witness?
He's available. Chris is available to answer questions if you've got any at this stage.
Okay, well, we have your name and occupation for the record.
My name is Chris Herman. I'm an attorney with the Stolreeves Law Firm in Portland.
Fine. Thank you. Members of the committee, questions? I have several. Perhaps these might be directed to counsel because I'm trying to conceptualize how this actually works. Am I correct in assuming that in the scenario that you're presenting that the liability has been established and it's a question of allocation of that liability among insurance companies? I want to make sure we're on the same page on this.
Right. There are two categories of liability. The first is the liability of an entity for the environmental cost. We're not talking about that. What we're saying is where, because of the environmental claim that has been made against a company and the company looks to its historical insurance carriers, if the policies that those carriers issued to the company do provide coverage, then under the terms of that policy, then what this legislation says is that the policyholder can then, let's just say that there are five insurance companies that wrote insurance over a many-year period, the policyholder can then go to any one of those five and say, I've established coverage, there's property damage during the policy period, exclusions don't apply, you have $1 million limit, there's $1 million cleanup here, please pay $1 million under the policy. And once that payment is made, then what the bill provides is that insurance company that has paid can then in turn go to the other four insurers and between themselves then figure out what their respective contribution would be for that amount.
Now, I'm assuming this adjudication of liability takes place either in a judicial or an administrative proceeding. Would that be correct?
It can. What the hope of the proponents of the legislation is that, in fact, litigation will not be required, that with this allocation rule in place, and as an attorney who practices in this area, what we see is in states that are the nine states that have already adopted this rule, in those states what happens most frequently is that the policyholder will go to one or several carriers, and because of this all-sums allocation rule, they will negotiate a payment, which is what provides the money on an accelerated basis, and then the carriers in turn will allocate among themselves. If you can't reach a negotiated agreement, then there is recourse to litigation either in state or federal court, and those are principally the two principal ways in which this gets resolved.
Okay, just a couple more questions on this so I can understand it. If liability has been established, say, at a judicial forum, isn't it most likely that those insurance companies would have participated in that proceeding representing their insurers?
Representing their insureds?
Their insurers.
Their insurers? If there is litigation between a policyholder and its insurance companies, then all of the insurers presumably are in that litigation.
And could that allocation process take place through the contribution method in court, or are we looking at something outside of that?
It could, although I think it could either take place as part of that proceeding or it could take place in a separate proceeding. I think the likelihood is that it would take place as part of that same proceeding.
Okay. On page 30, line 36 of page 2 of the bill, is a situation where an insured has more than one insurance policy. Isn't there another situation where a landowner may have, we may have multiple landowners, multiple persons that are liable, like successors in interest or predecessors in interest that might also have insurance? And is that covered here? I mean, it seems like you're just covering the initial immediate landowner.
What it says is that anyone who is determined to be identified as a potentially responsible party can look to their own insurance and can tender it, and this is the process for them to then proceed to obtain insurance. If there are other responsible parties, they are able to do the same thing under their insurance policies. It doesn't attempt to allocate between the parties that are liable on the environmental liability.
Okay, I think it answers my questions. Thank you.
All right, further. Representative Shetterly, then Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure we'll hear about this from the opponents, but I thought I'd just ask the question while you're here at the table. And one issue that I think would be worth clarifying, does this allocation process raise the risk that an insurer may ultimately have to pay out on a claim that factually arises from a period of time other than the period in which the insurer provided coverage for a piece of property? Let's say if you bring them in because they're within this period of time, they're one of the policyholders on the property over the history of the property, but I guess if they provided coverage for segment A of time, but the discharge may factually have occurred in the B segment, do you have a risk there of some liability for coverage where the policy, in fact, would not have otherwise?
No, in the example that you just gave, the only claim could be made against an insurer who was providing insurance during a time period when property damage occurred. And so, and the example was you have insurance company A for period one, then insurance company B for period two, and the release occurs in period two, then there could be no claim to an earlier carrier because, again, this doesn't change the requirements of the policy. And what the policyholder has to do in order to get coverage sort of as an initial matter is to satisfy the requirements of the insuring agreement. And one of those is that the policyholder prove that there was property damage that occurred during the policy period.
Mr. Chair, if I may go back and answer a question Representative Ackerman had for the explanation. One of the cases Schnitzer had is when they were a neighbor property holder to a contaminated site and the pollution migrated onto their property. Mm-hmm. So in that case, which was a very large Portland environmental case, the adjudication came down, the ultimate settlement came down, that not only was the principal polluter involved for a certain amount, but all of the other parties got drawn in. So your question of are there other people that may be liable here? In each of these complicated cases, yes, under CERCLA, it's my best understanding that, yes, you can sue. Everybody is jointly and severably liable. And so, but that, if you get into adjudication or if the insurance company comes in and tenders a defense and wants to get into doing that, that's where those things get worked out. Is that?
Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question may be best directed to Mr. Herman. I'm looking at a letter I have in my bill file here from the Lower Willamette Group, which recites some facts about the Portland Harbor Superfund site. And it states that there are 69 companies that are potentially responsible parties in that site. And I see, and I think I heard Mr. Gallagher just say that those parties are jointly and severally liable for the cleanup. That is, the entire cost of cleaning up the Superfund site could fall on any one of them. Mm-hmm. And would the effect of this bill, then, if enacted, be that any insurer of any one of them would then be responsible up to its policy limits for the cleanup project? That is, by being an insurer of any one of those jointly and severally liable parties, they would be responsible, with then the opportunity to go back against other insurers?
If I understand your question right, the answer is yes, with the qualification always being that any policyholder making a claim would have to show that they were liable up to that amount due to property damage that they could show occurred during the policy period. So if they had $1 million limit, and there's some estimates that say the overall Portland Harbor cleanup cost is going to be $500 million. The effect of this bill, this legislation, wouldn't be to make every insurance company responsible for $500 million. It would only say where I come in as a policyholder, if I have liability and can, because of property damage that occurred during the policy period, then I could recover in an amount not to exceed the policy limit for my particular policy. So whatever that is, that's an absolute limit. But the reason I'm making the claim is because I do have joint and several liability. That's again with respect to the environmental authorities under the environmental laws.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
Each of these PRPs, potentially responsible parties, then may have one or maybe multiple insurers that are responsible for different periods. And my understanding of the bill is that it would make each insurer responsible up to its policy limit, with an opportunity then to claim for contribution again. And I'm not sure that's a technically accurate term, but that would be the effect of it to other insurers. Would that extend to just the other co-insurers for different periods of time with respect to that PRP, or does it extend to all the potential insurers of all the potential PRPs?
No, it would just extend to other insurers of that insured.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions, Representative Prusansky.
Thank you. Mr. Herman, you mentioned about, I think, 9 states that have adopted this type of legislation, and that it has resulted in where there's not as much or very little litigation that is going forward because of the changes in the law. Is that correct?
The nine states that have adopted this as the majority rule have not done so legislatively. Those are states in which the rule has been adopted by the Supreme Court of the particular state, and that's just on this allocation rule.
Okay.
And in the states where the all sums allocation rule has been adopted, there is still litigation in this area, but the litigation focuses on other coverage issues, not so much the allocation issue. And the really critical thing in the states where, such as Washington, where the all sums rule has been adopted, is that, you know, in each one of these environmental situations, you really have two obligations that come into play on the part of the insurance carriers. There's the duty to defend, which is a part of the policy language, and there's the duty to indemnify, which is to pay the ultimate cost of the cleanup. And a really critical thing to keep in mind, and what would be a primary immediate impact and effect of this legislation, is that you would get money from the insurers to pay for those defense costs, which are the site investigation costs and the selection of the remedy costs, on an accelerated basis. That's been my experience in states with that. So that's probably the primary impact of this. But again, it's not a panacea. It doesn't eliminate any and all disputes about coverage. As Mr. Gallagher was saying, there were some other pieces in the original legislation that would have tried to pick up some of these other issues. But it's now been reduced down to what we view as sort of the principal issue, which is in Oregon, delaying or hindering the funding of the initial site investigations, which in turn seriously delays the ultimate implementation of a cleanup.
Quick follow-up.
You may.
With that in mind, I understand like a factual issues would still be needing to be litigated as to whether or not there's actually a claim under the time or term of the policy. Do any of these states require any type of like arbitration or other types of alternative dispute resolutions to try to resolve these type of issues where court time-wise they're not necessarily going to be tied up?
I'm not aware of any states that have special statutes or regulations that require mediation in this area, although it is something that as a matter of practice happens quite often, that carriers and policyholders will agree to mediation as a way to try and conserve the resources of the judiciary.
Is this question, though, about the ultimate liability or about the allocation?
Probably more on the allocation as compared to liability. I understand that's still right. Going to be out there. It seems like it just seems to me that if you have these rules in place, that you're going to maybe keep the parties out of court, and it really just gets down to the point of allocation of the...
Yes, you know, based on my practice and based on my experience, that is right. That is a primary impact, is that you don't have litigation over the allocation. And in general, you spare on litigation.
Were there other questions for the panel? The question I had for you, Mr. Herman, is sort of the concept, and we've sort of talked around the edges, and I apologize I was out for the first couple of minutes of your hearing, attending to another matter. But the issue of essentially what is right now a responsibility in states that don't have the all sums approach of the policyholder, of the insured, to sort of bear the transactional burden of dealing with these individual insurance companies, and then the all sums approach essentially slides that transactional burden away from the insured, who gets to go to the best target for the likely, you know, resources for the coverage, and at least initiate that process under the all sums approach. But yet the insurance companies then bear obviously that same transactional burden, as they then begin sort of amongst themselves trying to sort out who's responsible and for what period and how much and the rest. And I guess I'm interested in just sort of having the community get a sense of your thoughts about the policy, the public policy behind that shift in burden. And I recognize that it depends on your view of what the all sums contract in those general policies, what all sums meant, and I think that's going to be one of the issues we probably hear from the other side. But assuming your view of what all sums means in that policy, I want you to talk about the public policy ramifications of that choice.
By shifting the, if you want to call it that, shifting the burden to the carriers, in the circumstance, what you do is you make funds available on an accelerated basis for the investigation work itself. And the cost, to the extent that there are any costs or significant costs associated in the carriers reaching agreement on how they should share them among themselves, are really a burden that the carriers accepted when they themselves wrote the policies that had the all sums provision in it. And I think parenthetically, what you see when dealing from our perspective representing policyholders alone, what you see is where the carriers acknowledge responsibility and liability and sit down, they appear from our perspective to be able to rather quickly in most cases reach agreement among themselves about how the cost is going to be divided, and there doesn't seem to be and it doesn't have any impact then on the actual performance of the site investigation. And contrary-wise, in a state like Oregon right now where there isn't a clear rule, in very many of the cases that I work on, we spend literally sort of years trying to negotiate a satisfactory agreement among the carriers and between the carrier and the insured. And very often that the investigation work either doesn't happen at all or happens on a very delayed schedule.
And let's talk about that for a minute. I know it's impossible because it probably varies on a case-to-case-to-case basis, but give us a sort of run-of-the-mill. I would say that the Portland Harbor cleanup case is not run-of-the-mill. But pick a run-of-the-mill environmental case that you deal with on a regular basis and give us some sense of the scope of the total dollars that are spent in resolving the issue that are spent sort of on the early part of the allocation issue before you even get to the to the starting of the investigation and the cleanup stage versus then the final indemnity portion. I mean, do you have any sort of rough proportion?
Talking about the legal costs incurred?
Yeah, just generally the legal costs associated with that.
The typical sort of not Portland Harbor site in Oregon, in my experience, is sort of a $2 to $5 million cleanup cost overall once you actually get into it. But what you see is that if there's a dispute about allocation, which there often is at the front end, then a company will spend easily in the several tens of thousands of dollars, if not more, in this initial period of trying to get an agreement with the insurance carriers. And in addition to that burden, which, you know, some of the very large companies in the state are able to fund that out of their own pockets, but there are many smaller companies that we represent that really find that to be quite a burdensome expense. So you're looking at you know, several tens of thousands, sometimes much more than that, in this initial negotiating phase. But just as importantly, what's happening during that phase, and it can last 6 months to a year or longer, is that very often then the company will turn to DEQ and say, we're not in a position to make commitments on what we're going to do because there's such uncertainty about the availability of funding from insurance companies or from other sources. And the other thing that happens is that to the extent that I have a case right now where this is happening, and this, I think, highlights the problem, it's a small metal fabrication company in East Multnomah County. Their choice right now is they have a major business opportunity with a large manufacturer in the Portland area. It's going to cost them about $50,000 to buy the equipment they need to produce a product that they would then sell to this large manufacturer. Their choice is they either spend the $50,000 on the investigation right now, which the carrier is not willing to pay for, or the carriers are not willing to pay for, or they can buy this equipment. And so that's their bind. And if the all sums rule were in place, I think we would be able to get to an agreement with the carriers right away on funding of the investigation, and that money would have been freed up for this business opportunity. And right now that opportunity is being lost because there is an ongoing debate about who should pay and who should pay how much and so on. And so that's another – it's hard to quantify the cost of the company, but it's those lost opportunities that very often come up because companies aren't getting funding right away from their carriers and then have to use their own funds or not do the investigation and then pursue their business activity.
I think I can say as an insured, the greatest, because this isn't our only environmental challenge out there, the greatest fear that you have when you confront something like this is all of the assets being consumed in transaction costs, so that by the time the actual cleanup starts, you got nothing to work with except for your other corporate assets. And in our case, they're limited.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the list, Mark Nelson was signed up, but I haven't seen him come back into the room. So he got waylaid somewhere. Okay. That could happen. Jack Monroe, Sean Miller, Laura Foggin. Did I get that right? Did I miss someone else, too? Diane?
Diane Pulser.
Pulser, okay. Pull up an extra chair if you could. There's one over here on the side, Sean. Well, welcome, and whoever is ready.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe, here today on behalf of the American Insurance Association. I'd like to introduce Diane Pulser, a principal in the Portland firm of Gordon and Pulser. They are active in a great number of environmental liability cases. I won't say all of them, but a great number of them. And she has considerable experience in this area. I think Sean will introduce our other guest.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the National Association of Independent Insurers. Do want to introduce Laura Foggin with the she's legal counsel with the Complex Insurance Claims Litigation Association that deals with these matters. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I did submit a letter from Michael Keyes, President CEO of Oregon Mutual, reflects the position of NAII members that do business in Oregon. We have about 214 members that do property casualty insurance in Oregon, about 35% of the personal lines. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Diane and Laura.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My name is Diane Pulser, as Jack mentioned, and what I've done for the last 15 years is quite a bit of, as Mr. Herman could tell you, counsel for the Port of Portland, environmental insurance coverage. And I'm here to talk to you about, I can't argue with what the folks from Schnitzer said or the Port of Portland or Mr. Herman about jobs in Oregon or cleaning up the environment. Everybody is in favor of that. But what I can tell you on a very dry topic is I've read insurance policies, I know what insurance policies say, and it's not as simplistic as counsel or representatives from those organizations would have you believe. And what I mean by that is the all sums language says more than all sums. It says all sums to which this insurance applies. And it applies during the policy period. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is, and I think Representative Przanski recognized that this issue has not been before, to my knowledge, a single legislature in the State of the Union. Washington did not address this issue legislatively, and so what you are being asked to do, and I guarantee you, you will be in, you know, I shouldn't say that. That's overstatement. I predict you will be in business insurance if you pass this litigation. This is a new piece of legislation that has never been before any other legislature, to my knowledge. And so you're going in unknown territory. I'm here to tell you about five key points. I guess the first key point is I would ask you to delete. We're down from 6-2, somebody said. I would ask you to go down from 6-1. Delete the language relating to all sums, and I'll tell you the reasons why. Number one, you would be reversing existing Oregon trial court decisions which are currently on appeal. These decisions will be coming down. I predict, I don't have a crystal ball, I don't have, you know, a view into the future, but responsive briefs have been filed. These issues have been addressed by very competent jurists in the state of Oregon. The issue will be decided. It will be decided. It was decided, as Mr. Herman represented, in the state of Washington by the Washington Supreme Court in the insured's favor. Where it's coming from, though, is out of Multnomah County, out of other counties. It is not in that position where we are now. That's not to say that the Oregon Court of Appeals couldn't go along with what the Washington Supreme Court did, but that's not where you are now. That's not where Oregon law is now, and that's not where I would propose that legislative resources, again, you folks have your prerogative to do whatever you want, and you have certainly have addressed other issues that are in the province of the judiciary. I'm not saying leave it to the courts. What I am saying is it is a very complex issue that from all the questions we heard this afternoon, and I could go, I'm not going to bore you because you don't have all afternoon. I could go on about each one of your questions and respond to, from our perspective, from the insurer's perspective, each one of those questions and how complicated it is. So, number one, you're going in uncharted territory. Legislature has not gone there. Number two, you're going to be reversing cases which are on appeal. Number three, and I suspect that you have had this briefed by your legislative counsel, you will be interfering with private contracts. You will be retroactively legislating contracts that were entered into 10, 20, 30 years ago. And I suspect this isn't the end of the story in that regard. Let me give you an example. Let's take a local company. Oregon Mutual writes 1 year of coverage. And they are picked. You know, the tag, you're it, all sums. So you're it. This legislation, I don't know how many of you understand, but it allows the insured to pick. So you pick Oregon Mutual. They wrote a year of coverage. They were also insured by Reliance for 10 years. Reliance is out of business. Does that mean that the insured is then going to pick up that share, or is Oregon Mutual going to pay for all of that? If you insured 1 year, 1969, does that mean you're going to be the insurance company on the hook for the next 30 years? So getting back to, so I gave you 3 points, and I promised five. Point number four, all sums to which this insurance applies. You have to read out the language occurred during the policy period. So, again, getting back to, and my final and fifth point, and then I'll turn this over, Laura Foggin's going to address the loss policy issue. I'm simply here to talk about the all sums issue. If the goal is, as I saw some legislative pronouncement about what the goal of this legislation is, one of the major goals is to reduce litigation, get money in the hands of the people that need the money to clean up the environment. I can tell you that from my perspective, and I have sat across the table from Mr. Herman, who sat here addressing the issue from counsel's perspective for the insured's point of view, I've sat across the table from him. From my perspective, it is not going to reduce the cost of litigation, and I'll tell you why. Give you an example. Pollution liability insurance. That is a specific type of insurance. Lloyd's, they write manuscripted policies. Other types of insurance, EIL insurance. This legislation covers CGL insurance. You are still going to have the issue of the most specific type of insurance that may be applicable to the claim isn't even brought to the table. So you are allocating to one particular type of insurance by statute. Again, a good reason to let the judiciary, and they have. I've been involved in cases. They have dealt with the specific policy language. I can tell you in the Port case, without getting, you know, we settled that case, I can't get into the confidences of it, but there are various types of insurance that apply. It's not simply one simple type of insurance. And it's not that simple. So let the court look at the particular policy language, decide what applies and what doesn't apply, and it's not going to reduce transaction costs, and collect from the appropriate party. Don't just take this piece of legislation as a very simplistic approach to a very complicated problem. And again, I started by saying I'm all in favor of getting money in the hands of whoever needs to clean up the environment, but it can't be at the expense of not understanding. You can't legislate out what is clear policy language. Thanks. I'll turn it over.
Thank you. Ms. Foggin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, representatives. I appreciate the opportunity to address this legislation, and I'll just comment that on behalf of CICLA, the Complex Insurance Claims Litigation Association, we agree with the comments that Ms. Pulser made that this legislation would eliminate flexibility that's necessary to fairly resolve allocation disputes as the individual circumstances of a situation dictate. And for that reason, we also urge that Section 3 be deleted. I'd like to address Section 4, though, and two particular aspects of Section 4. With respect to Section 4, we believe that there are two areas of that provision that should be amended. And one is that Section 4 addresses loss policies, and it seeks to change the law on the standard of proof that will govern proof of a lost instrument. Oregon law generally on lost instruments requires a preponderance, more than a preponderance of the evidence. It requires clear and convincing or a high probability that a lost instrument existed. This is an important standard, long-standing in Oregon law, that protects a circumstance where we don't know whether or not a document existed and the original cannot be produced, and we have to go back and reconstruct its possible terms. And this proposed legislation, almost in passing, provides language that proof would now be simply by a preponderance of evidence. And we ask you to amend that to either be silent and leave it to the courts or to reinforce what Oregon law currently provides, which is a higher, clear, and convincing standard. The second point in Section 4 that I would like to address is this, that really the thrust of Section 4 is to find out the truth. Was there a policy that was issued, and what were the terms and conditions of that policy? And to accomplish that, it should provide for a mutual exchange of information between the insurer and the policyholder with respect to any information that's located about a lost or missing instrument. And this provision does not currently do so. Instead, it provides a series of obligations and duties on the part of the insurer only. And as it happened, because of my role as counsel to CICLA and its predecessor, the Insurance Environmental Litigation Association, I had occasion to work very closely with Commissioner Sen and her staff on the Washington regulations that have been referenced by the proponents of this bill. And I'd like to compare for you some of the actual provisions of the Washington regulations and this bill. And the portion of this bill that I'm going to refer to appears at page 4 at lines 2 to 8. And I'm going to, just if you'll bear with me, quickly reference a couple of provisions in the Washington bill and then this bill to give you that contrast. The Washington regulations, I should say. The Washington regulation, 284.30.921b, provides this. Insureds and insurers shall fully cooperate with each other in the investigation of lost policy issues. This bill provides the insurer shall cooperate with the insured in determining the terms of a lost policy. The next section of the Washington regulations provides each shall provide to the other facts known or discovered during an investigation, including the identity of any witnesses with knowledge of facts related to the issuance or existence of a lost policy, whereas this bill provides the insurer shall provide to the insured facts known or discovered during an investigation, including the identity of any witnesses with knowledge of facts related to the issuance or existence of a lost policy, and so on and so forth. So that instead of creating a mutual exchange of information in a search for the truth, an even-handed reciprocal obligation to provide all the evidence we know about a missing or lost document, this current bill does not do so. And we urge you to make those duties reciprocal, to make the exchange of information even-handed. And we do that because, in fact, policyholder records may often contain the best information about any insurance that the policyholder purchased. A policyholder may more easily identify its own broker. It may more easily, through its financial records, be able to establish whether a premium was paid and the amount of the premium, which could be important evidence about the scope and amount of coverage. Its records may show a pattern of the type and amounts of coverage that it bought in the relevant time periods. For example, it bought a policy from insurer A in 1960, and the limits were $500,000. In 1961, a policy is missing. In 1962, it bought a policy from insurer C for $500,000. In 1963, through whatever, $500,000. It tells us something about what a court might find the limits of the missing policy would be. This is important evidence that most typically is found in the policyholder's records. There's a wealth of information bearing on the issuance and terms of a missing policy that would be found only in the policyholder's own files. And fairness requires that that information be brought forward as well in a search for the information necessary to reconstruct a policy. Requiring that kind of mutual exchange of information would improve the ability of the parties and the courts to reconstruct the truth. It would inform an insurer's search to have whatever facts are known to the policyholder at the insurer's disposal to look in the right place to get the information. And it also might very well improve the policyholder's ability to demonstrate that a policy was actually issued if that information is brought forward and included in the exchange of information put before the court. In addition, information in a policyholder's files can shed light on deductibles, on self-insured retention agreements, or retrospective premium charges, which may inextricably be tied to coverage terms and limits. And it's only fair that this information be disclosed as well in trying to truly reconstruct the terms of the policy. And so for these reasons, we urge two amendments to Section 4. First, that the existing standard of proof be preserved, and second, that the exchange of information in seeking to reconstruct a lost or missing policy be mutual or reciprocal, that both parties have the obligation to participate equally in sharing information with the other to try to establish the truth of a missing policy or document. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hagen. Questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Prezanz.
If I can just follow up on this last one. Is it Ms. Bogan?
Bogan. Yes, thank you.
I'm intrigued by your positions as to what you'd like for us to do if we move forward on this bill. And I guess I want to wonder if you can tell us what Washington State or any other state requires as sanctions where there isn't fairness followed by either party.
There are provisions in the Washington regulations relating to sanctions. Those provisions, the Washington regulations, as you may know, or Mr. Chairman, as the representatives and members of the committee may know, are part of the Washington Unfair Claim Regulation provisions. Unlike these, which currently, as I understand it, would fall under the Environmental Department's area of expertise. And so I think that the way to handle that here would be, as a proposed amendment from the Insurance Department suggests, to give authority for regulatory follow-up to determine what sanctions, if any, should follow failure to comply here on the part of either party.
Follow-up?
I do have a follow-up.
Okay.
Jack, if you'll just hold on to
sure.
that. I mean, the one thing that struck me when I read through the testimony that was provided to us from the Snitzer's group, testimony from Tom Linka, I guess, it's on page 2, where it talks about in the course of that experience they came up with the lost policy, and it states, although Snitzer had clear documentation that Lloyd's of London had issued a policy to Snitzer, it did not have an actual copy of the policy. It wrote Lloyd's, providing, among other things, the specific policy number, the policy period, and requested copies of that policy. And basically, not only did they fail to provide that information, they basically looked like they thumbed their nose for 4 years until Snitzer had to go through a litigation process, and then under court order, they actually then released that information. To me, that seems like someone is not being fair in providing and getting through this litigation. And so I understand what you're asking for, but it seems like, at least from the perspective I'm hearing, you are representing individuals. I don't know if you represent Lloyd's of London or not, but here's a company that actually did everything it could to basically deflect its responsibility in being fair at the table.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Prezanski, I don't actually represent Lloyd's of London, and I can't sanction conduct where a known document is withheld. Ordinarily, that would be produced in the existing litigation procedures. You know, there are fundamental, and prior to existing litigation procedures, for that matter. It's not a question of a guessing game. It is a question of an exchange of information. But similarly, there are circumstances where an insurer is presented with a claim and the policyholder does not come forward with relevant information about its policy terms or limits. And our proposal is simply that if this legislation does proceed with respect to Section 4, that the obligation be there and that it be reciprocal.
One last follow-up.
Yes.
Can you tell me what the current state of the law is in Oregon regarding lost policies as to denying coverage where a policy, for whatever reason, is not able to be produced and provided back to the insurer by the insured?
Well, basically, in any state if there is no policy and the terms of the policy cannot be established, then the law presumes that there is no policy and therefore there is no coverage obligation. Just as if there is no banknote and the terms of a banknote cannot be established, there is no duty to pay. It is, in other words, in parallel with any lost instrument law. The Oregon law traditionally on lost instruments has been that if you can demonstrate by preponderance of evidence, by clear and convincing evidence, that in fact a document exists and what its material terms were, then you can establish the obligation to pay. And that is true for an insurance policy as it would be for a banknote or any other policy. It's not a simple, is it there or not, do you recover or not, but unless you can demonstrate that it existed and what the material terms were, then you cannot recover, just as you could not on any lost instrument.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, could I add to that? Oregon law is, there is no, to answer your question, there is, Representative Przanski, there is no Oregon appellate law currently on lost policies for insurance policies. Oregon law generally is a clear and convincing standard for something like a deed or a will or a corporate note. That issue, however, as I said about earlier issues, is on appeal before the Court of Appeals. And I know there are a lawyer, there's a lawyer or two in the audience who has responded to that in briefing with respect to that issue. So again, that issue will be decided shortly by the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask Ms. Foggin a question about the standard of proof issue, and then I have a question for you, Ms. Polser, and I know that there are other committee members that still have questions. And I got caught up listening to your statements about the mutual obligation issues and pointing out the differences in the Washington rule and this bill. And I in doing so, I think I missed maybe the point that you were making with respect to the standard of proof. And Ms. Polser just clarified that we're currently, at least it appears at the trial level, sort of borrowing other lost instrument standards of proof in a clear and convincing. But was that the sole rationale for keeping it at a clear and convincing standard, is that that's sort of what we've already always done and it's consistent with other standards? But did you articulate, or did I miss you articulating some other rationale as to why we ought to keep it at a clear and convincing standard, in your opinion, as to going to a preponderance standard? And if so, I guess I missed it, and I'd like you to restate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are a host of reasons supporting the clear and convincing standard for any lost instrument, and they are obviously a protection against fraud, where you could have an unscrupulous person come forward and claim the existence of a lost instrument or claim to have a right to recovery when, in fact, there was no such policy or banknote or whatever it might be. And all of the traditional arguments that have been made in favor of the clear and convincing standard for demonstrating the existence of something that cannot be shown directly, i.e. there is no actual document to establish this, would apply, we believe, with equal force to insurance policies as they would to any other lost instrument. And to date, there's been no deviation in Oregon law. As you articulated a moment ago and Ms. Polser said, there has been an argument that perhaps the standard should be altered with respect to insurance policies, but we don't believe that insurance policies are fundamentally different than other lost instruments, and they should be subject to the general lost instrument law, just as insurance policies are generally subject to contract law in the state of Oregon.
Okay. It's an interesting one, because it seems to me that at least the issue of that standard, while I know there may be issues on appeal right now as to what the current Oregon standard is, this one seems a place where, you know, for all sorts of potential policy reasons, you know, the legislature could step in and define what that standard was, in part based, I think, on the fact that the public benefit, to the extent that the laws with respect to environmental cleanup went back and all of a sudden triggered a whole bunch of discussion that nobody necessarily ever anticipated. Therefore, dealing with an issue of lost policies all of a sudden took on a whole different set of significance that I think no one intended. And there is some value, I think, to having that issue resolved in a way that's clear and that isn't unfairly burdensome one way or the other. clear and convincing is a pretty high standard in those situations. When we're talking about sometimes property owners or the like who own property that has been out of use by that owner for years and years and years and years, but is now the subject of this kind of an action. Let me ask you, Ms. Pulser, a question, and I wanted to make sure I was tracking with your reasoning. You gave an example, just a hypothetical of an Oregon Mutual, a year's worth of coverage versus a Reliance Insurance that's now defunct with 10 years' worth of coverage. And the possibility that then Oregon Mutual gets tagged for all of the obligation. But as I understood, I thought at least the proponents on this bill testifying that the maximum exposure to Oregon Mutual would be its exposure within the policy limits that it had. So, I mean, it would only be exposed to its maximum policy limits. So to the extent this 10 years of obligation for Reliance exceeded Oregon Mutual's policy limits, then they would just be on the hook for what they had committed to be on the hook for when they wrote the policy originally and said these are the limits to which we're going to be obligated. I mean, isn't that, am I wrong about that?
Well, it's a little bit more complex than that. I think that if you have 10 years of property damage and your expert testifies that one-tenth of it happened during Oregon Mutual's policy period, but nine-tenths of it happened during Reliance's policy period, is there an ambiguity as to what happens to that other nine-tenths? Who's going to pay for that?
Well, that's a good question, and if that's the point you're making, that to the extent that it was a slow period and not all attributable in a single year, and I'll bring the proponents up at some point when we're done here, and I'll put that question to them, because I think that's one that they ought to answer to the committee. But you would agree with me, as the bill is currently written, Oregon Mutual's exposure under your hypothetical would be no greater than its maximum policy limits.
Absolutely, that would be my position, plus defense costs.
Right, but that's how the bill reads as it's currently drafted.
But defense costs can often be many, many fold times greater than policy limits.
And that would sort of be the whole
that's
point
your point.
Of this discussion.
That's your point.
That is correct.
Is that the defense costs can be so much larger, hence the wrangling. Representative McPherson, I assume that you looked microphone positioned.
I am indeed, Mr. Chair. And I have several questions for Ms. Pulser, and with your indulgence.
And I'm sorry, I had gone over. I thought I did see a thing. Is that all right? We'll come back to you, Representative Ackerman. I apologize.
To defer to our Vice Chair. But I don't have experience myself with respect to environmental liabilities, but I do have experience in my area of practice with health benefits in which there are multiple insurers who may be responsible for the same obligation, and the insurance industry within that area of activity has a rather elaborate set of standards that are called the coordination of benefits rules that essentially sort out, as among insurers, who will be responsible for certain kinds of claims as to which multiple companies could be. Is there anything of that sort developing within the insurance industry where you could have, with respect to environmental claims, where you have potentially shared responsibility by multiple insurers?
As a practical matter, sometimes before litigation, insurers are able to work it out, quote, among themselves, but often they're not.
But that's in response to a particular controversy. There's not an established practice that's developing within the industry. That's my question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, most policies have that kind of language, but I think we're mixing up a couple of different factual situations. The health incident you're talking about is presumably an incident that occurs for which there might be redundant coverage, if you will, more than one insurer on the particular incident, in which case contractual language there would sort out who's going to be primary and who will be secondary and how that will be handled. The situation we're dealing with here, however, is a situation that, to use the examples, has occurred over a period of time, and there are a number of different carriers, either at the primary or excess level, who might bear some portion of the responsibility for what has gone on over a period of time. And so, frankly, the language that's there relative to how we will sort it out for the year that we were on it in 1956, that language is there. There is not language that's there to cover how you might sort it out for the 40 years or 20 years, one of which you were on the risk. And so I think it's a different situation.
With respect to the Portland Superfund site, the harbor site, how many insurers are there who are or might be obligated with respect to the cleanup costs?
What? Mr. Herman?
I, having represented one of the insurers and we settled and there's a confidentiality agreement and there's already been issues relating to that, I don't even want to comment on the Port of Portland issues because that some of that is confidential.
Yeah, how many insurers are there that are potentially exposed with respect to the Portland Harbor cleanup?
Not just the Port of Portland.
I'm sorry, the Portland Harbor, the Superfund site. I don't mean Port of Portland, I meant the harbor.
Okay, let's put the question to the witnesses because we're not going to pick up all the rest of that stuff on the other stuff. So I'm going to bring
that's fine.
Some people back to answer some other questions, but that's
right. That's fine. Why don't we set that over until they come back up? Then, Ms. Polser, one last question. You mentioned trial decisions that are on appeal now. Do they go to both pieces or both issues that are in the bill, both loss policy and the question of all sums as opposed to pro rata? I see you're nodding yes. So the question is, I think I understood from the testimony earlier that those are decisions that were decided in favor of a pro rata approach and that they're on appeal then asking the Oregon Court of Appeals to presumably the other side is seeking to have an all sums position adopted in Oregon on appeal.
That is my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions to the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackerman had some, and then we'll go to Representative Przanski. Are you okay?
Okay.
Representative Przanski.
Just one follow-up on the on Section 4. When, on page 4 of the bill, this is Section 4, subsection 7, starts on lines 37, goes through 39. Talks about what an insurer may claim as an affirmative defense. I'm wondering how that... what the response would be if we were going to make the change to clear and convincing. Does that not provide for the insurer the ability to contest that the insured is not meeting the minimum standards?
To be frank, if I may answer, Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, I find this language a little confusing in that it's unclear to me how to interpret it. It could be, indeed, that if the clear and convincing standard were incorporated, that would moot this issue because that would be the standard and each side would have the ability to test the evidence in accordance with that governing standard. The reference here, however, might be to something about the diligence in conducting the search for information as opposed to demonstrating the existence of the policy. And in that respect, I find it confusing, frankly, and it could be that this would still be necessary in order to provide the insurer with the ability to say that where the policyholder was not diligent in providing the name of the insured or other basic information that would be necessary to conduct a search, hence that resulted in the insurer's inability to thoroughly search its records.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I just want to go back to the first page of the letter from the Oregon Mutual Insurance Company because I think there's a misquote in the body of that letter regarding Section 2, Sub 3 of the Act. The first three or four words of the letter says, quoting that section, an insurer has a duty to pay defense or indemnity costs. And the bill says an insurer with a duty. It seems to me that the word has is not correct, but that sort of directs a result. I wonder if the claim of constitutionality was based upon the fact that we were directing a result rather than seeking to interpret language. I'm just sort of throwing that out. I don't know the answer to it, but it might be something we should talk about. aside from that note, I just want to go back to your hypothetical where there's a 10-year period of pollution exposure. You have a policy in effect for 1 year. Is your interpretation under this bill that you have to pay the entire amount of the exposure? And if so, do you have any rights of contribution if there are other insurance companies involved for the other 9 years?
I guess I would turn that question around to Mr. Herman and say, is that what he's going to be arguing? I don't think the statute clearly says that.
Okay.
It does clearly state that there will be more litigation vis-a-vis insurers against each other. And the insured will most certainly, if we think we're going to save litigation costs, be drawn back into that litigation either as a witness or third party or somehow if they have a self-insured retention or if there's a self-insured part of it. In a case like the Port of Portland or Schnitzer, they will be drawn back into it, in my opinion. They will be drawn back into the litigation, and it's not going to be a panacea that we all think it is.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Vice Chairman Ackerman, to speak to that point, and it relates in my mind to a question that was asked earlier as well, which goes to the extent to which the obligation of the insurers to pay has been established before this scheme of allocation comes into play. And it is not clear to me that this legislation provides at all that the responsibility of each insurer to pay, the fact of coverage under the policy, is to have been shown before the allocation comes into play. In fact, I read this, perhaps incorrectly, as suggesting that so long as you establish any one insurer's coverage, you didn't have to worry about whether or not there was coverage under any of the other policies. You just tagged that one insurer with 100% responsibility, and it became that insurer's problem not only to sort out a fair allocation, but to figure out if the other policies responded at all. And if not, the insurer was left holding the bag.
Thank you.
Anything further? Representative Shetterly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being gone. I was down at another committee downstairs. But that kind of gets back, I think, to the question that I asked, because I understood that there was this, at least from having heard this in my office, I had understood that there was this risk of an insurer being found responsible for a claim that may have occurred completely outside of. But now, am I hearing as I walk back into them, that may be a misunderstanding as to the effect of the bill?
Well, I don't know. We're going to find out. We're going to bring up the proponents and get a little better clarification. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very
much. Mr. Chairman, I offer a couple of comments. One, in response to a much earlier question that Representative Korzanski asked, and you asked about enforcement. And I would want to note that we certainly would support the bill speaking to that issue, and the insurance division has offered up provisions to make clear that they are the authority that would have the ability to make rules and to deal with issues that are raised here. And the insurance division has a full panoply of powers that range from the ability to civilly sanction you to sort of the atom bomb, which is to jerk your certificate to do business here, and everything in between, subpoena. So there's a full range of powers here. But the bill, as it exists, clearly is silent on that issue, and therefore we would support their amendment. I guess the second comment that I would make is in response to Representative McPherson's question. And certainly the people from the port may have a better response and may have specific numbers. But we certainly know from individual cases that if we are looking at a 30, 40, 50-year time period, you are looking at multiple insurers over that period of time. Certainly multiple insurers on the what I'll call the primary level, in most cases multiple insurers on an excess a level above that, and depending upon what went on at any of those 69 sites, there might have been a range of specialty policies that were also written to cover certain kinds of activities there. If the land was leased to somebody, whoever the party was who was occupying it might also have had policies. So The short answer is there are a lot of policies out there, or potentially out there as it relates to one site, not to mention 69 or 70 or however many that you might mention. And I think that might go to a recognition of that fact might at least suggest that we need to continue to retain the flexibility to have, let's say, a jurist take a look at the factual situation surrounding a site or a series of sites, the contracts that relate to those sites, and any other pertinent matters, and come up with what might be the optimally fair conclusion given the complexities of a particular situation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scherer.
I just want to thank Mr. Monroe. I think that's the first time all session I've heard panoply from a word. Good word.
We'd like to
I'm glad we're still here to hear it.
Next it will be cornucopia. All right. Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
Halloween.
Why don't we ask, well, we've got Mr. DiLorenzo next on the list, so why don't you come up, John, and tell us about your amendment, and then... Yeah, I'll probably have Mr. Herman come back up after that. Okay. Mark, you were gone. We skipped over you. Do you still need to talk? All right, we'll let you go after... No, we'll let you go after John. No, go ahead, John. You're up there. Go ahead. Tell us about your amendment.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm appearing here this afternoon on behalf of my client, ICN Pharmaceuticals, Inc. ICN Pharmaceuticals is here in support of the A6 amendments to Senate Bill 297. Some of you may recall that my client was the chief proponent in the 1999 session for Senate Bill 1205. Which became the Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act, which has since been codified in Chapter 465 and which this bill seeks to amend. In the mid-1970s, my client purchased the United Medical Laboratories operation near the Portland International Airport. UML operated the nation's largest mail-order pathology laboratory at that site beginning in 1961. ICN ran the laboratory facility from 1972 until approximately 1979, at which time operations terminated when hospitals no longer needed outside pathology services. Another business concern by the name of Drum Recovery operated a drum recycling business in the early 1980s across the street from the ICN laboratory. Among other things, Drum Recovery shipped hazardous waste materials generated by others to landfills. During the course of its operation, Drum Recovery was short of working capital and had been locked out of numerous hazardous waste landfills. And as a result, the principals began employing creative but illegal ways of disposing of hazardous waste. The principals of Drum Recovery were ultimately indicted for federal environmental crimes involving the dumping of sodium hydroxide at playgrounds and depositing transformers containing PCBs on ICN's property. One of Drum Recovery's principals served a significant time in federal prison, and others were placed on probation. A Drum Recovery employee testified in a deposition several years ago, which we took, that one of the illegal practices employed by Drum Recovery involved the dumping of hazardous materials into a dry well located on ICN's property after the laboratory had closed. In the early 1990s, ICN had an interest in selling the property. Because it was a laboratory operation, there were certain environmental concerns associated with the property in general. ICN approached the DEQ and volunteered to enter into a cleanup agreement under DEQ's supervision. ICN was accepted into the program and immediately began addressing the program and, in fact, addressed 4 out of 5 of the operable units. However, during the course of our remedial investigation, we discovered, much to our horror, that there were significant quantities of TCE, which is trichloroethylene, and 2 of TCE's breakdown products, DCE and vinyl chloride, in the vicinity of the dry well. The large quantities of TCE threatened a shallow aquifer, which was separated by a clay layer from the Tualatin Sandstone Aquifer, which is the aquifer from which the city of Portland derives its backup water supplying the Bull Run Reservoir. ICN did not use TCE or any of its breakdown products in any appreciable quantities during the course of its operations. ICN's investigation revealed that the TCE contamination was caused by the illegal dumping by Drum Recovery after the lab was closed. Over the last 2 years, ICN has employed a new technology called six-phase heating to literally boil the contaminants out of the groundwater by utilizing vast quantities of electricity to heat the soil surrounding the groundwater. A vapor extraction system has sucked up all of the steam and has removed significant quantities of pure TCE, DCE, and vinyl chloride. And we feel we've remediated about 99% of the contamination at this point, all under DEQ supervision. However, we have expended in excess of $7 million to accomplish this feat. Over the last several years, ICN has litigated with its insurers over coverage and over the qualified pollution exclusions that are contained in many of its comprehensive general liability policies. So far, we have litigated two actions, one against 13 underlying insurers and four excess carriers, and one lawsuit against three excess carriers. We have settled all of our claims with the underlying insurers and excess insurers in the first case, and we recently settled all of our claims with two out of three of the excess insurers in the most recent case. The third excess insurer refuses to settle, and our case may go to trial against that insurer alone. Although the terms of the settlements are subject to confidentiality agreements, it is no secret that generally insurers who settle with their insureds require one form of indemnity or another should they be brought back into a lawsuit or should some third party file an action against them with respect to the initial claim. Although we have no formal position concerning Senate Bill 297, we do note that the bill, including its all sums provisions, will apply generally to all claims arising before, on, or after the effective date of the Act. Now, we believe the new law should apply to parties who continue to litigate, whatever that new law is. But we also believe we have an obligation to protect those insurers with whom we have settled from being brought back into the fray by the only insurer who has been unwilling to settle with us. The settlement agreements we have reached with our other insurers have been made by them in good faith, and with respect to those agreements, they should be entitled to some degree of finality. And we believe that we are obligated to protect them now that they have finally settled with us. The bill, as it passed the Senate, has not addressed the circumstance in which litigation has been pending against a variety of insurance companies, many of whom have settled in good faith with the insured and some of whom have remained intransigent. ICN therefore proposes that you adopt the A6 amendments. Those amendments will allow the new law to be applicable to insurers who refuse to settle, but will not permit them to seek contribution from other insurers who, prior to the effective date of the Act, reached a binding settlement with the insured as to the claim. It may also collaterally help encourage settlements. If this amendment is not adopted, passage of the Act would require policyholders who have settled claims with some but not all companies to potentially be obligated to defend them, those with whom they settled, who may in turn be sued for contribution by the others who are unwilling to settle for providing all sums insurance under the scope of their coverages. Adoption of the Dash 6 amendments, I believe, will provide finality to all those who have settled in good faith and is in the interest of both insureds and insurers alike if this bill progresses. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the time you've afforded me, and I'm available to answer any questions the committee may have about either this or about the 1999 enactment.
Questions for Mr. DiLorenzo, Representative Pozanski.
Mr. Chair, I did not see the A6. I'm not sure if those have been distributed. And I'm wondering if...
I thought it was in my stack.
A7. I don't have it.
Got A7. I assume A6, John, is basically just saying when the effective date of the law would go, and it would be prospective as compared to retroactive.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pozanski, actually what the amendment does is it states, notwithstanding ORS 465.484, which is the reallocation contribution section of the bill in 297, an insurer that is a party to an action based on an environmental claim for which a final judgment after exhaustion of all appeals has not been entered on the effective date of this Act may not seek contribution from any other insurer that prior to the effective date of the Act reached a binding settlement with the insured as to the claim. Those were in Representative Williams's possession. I don't know what became of them.
I think they probably just, I thought they had gotten distributed to the committee, so they're probably floating around. We'll get copies out to the committee. We're not going to go into work session on the bill today anyway, but I'll have Mr. Taylor distribute copies of the amendments to the committee and make them available in the judiciary office for anybody who hasn't or would like to see them or hasn't seen them already. Any other questions for Mr. DiLorenzo? Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Metals Industry Council. I'll be very brief. I think as previous witnesses have indicated, there are over 500 sites in Oregon that have been classified by DEQ as having received some type of pollution contamination. We believe that this particular approach that you have in 297 represents a compromise over a much larger bill which started in the House. I might just comment that the two things that are still in this bill dealing with all sums and lost policies that you've heard about, what is not in the bill are provisions relating to defense costs, excess insurance, owned property exclusion, claims handling procedures, coverage for out-of-state sites. And I reference those to indicate the great degree of compromise that we've tried to move on this bill, both in the House and in the Senate. On the Senate side, there was an active work group in terms of both sides were engaged by the chair and by legal counsel. And I believe legal counsel put together, especially on the all sums approach, something that requires obligations on really both sides. And in terms of lost policies, we take some exception to some of the previous witnesses' comments because we do believe that the insured is required to make a thorough examination in terms of what information they have in their possession. I should just comment, the Port of Portland has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in the area of loss policies. It is to the benefit of the insured to try to find every piece of information that they can that's available to determine that there was in fact a policy that was issued. And this is primarily done initially by the fact that they usually have a check. They do have evidence that a policy has been paid for to a particular company. And the issue is you've heard some response has been, well, you don't have the policy, we don't have the policy. And, Mr. Chair, we believe that this provides a process by which we try to identify and get to an answer as opposed to saying we just don't have a policy. And that gets at the people we don't represent. The Oregon Metals Industry Council, most of those members have an ability, as Schnitzer has done, to try to proceed through this labyrinth to try to solve some of these problems. There are hundreds, as I've indicated, of other companies out there who don't have the wherewithal, who when they are told by the insurance company, you don't have the policy, we don't have the policy, and they stop. They don't move forward. And that's the advantage to the insurance company. We believe this gives a role, a proper step-by-step process by which we're going to, one, identify how what those loss policies were, and two, the all-sums approach, we believe, puts the emphasis up front to try to solve some of these issues through a process so that we can begin cleaning up some of these sites. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Nelson, Representative Crummell, then Representative Shetterly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understood the testimony received earlier from the previous panel, the issue is that the process, as you're describing, Mr. Nelson, is slanted more towards, if I understood it correctly, kind of an unfairness to the insurer versus the responsibility of the insured. Do you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I believe that discussion was in the area of the loss policies and a desire to put some requirements back on the insured. I don't have any objections to that. I believe the bill does that. I think it is in the interest of the insured to bring forward every piece of information. And I think if you brought Mr. Wyatt back up, he would give you great detail about their process in doing exactly that, to try to locate lost policies. So it is to the interest of the insurer to say, obviously you don't have the policy, we don't have the policy. I'm not saying that for all insurers, but that clearly has occurred in certain cases. It is in the interest of the insured to provide every single piece of information that they have in order to find that policy, so they can, the policy will pay for what they insured for and what the premium was paid for.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this lost policy provision, and you've got this process by which the insured is supposed to try to find the policy, then it goes to the insurer, the burden is on the insurer to do a diligent search, and then I guess we get to the point where no policy has been found, and I guess then the bill infers a policy. There's a process then by which the terms of the policy are going to be inferred from examination of other contemporaneous policies covering similar risks, and then I guess some evidence of what might have been the policy limits. I mean, is that? It sounds like the UCC kind of gap-filling provisions, I guess, where you can't, you know, where the parties may not have agreed on all the provisions. We're going to assume some. Is that what this basically does?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Herman can probably go into more detail. I think when it's all said and done after due diligence, and there is evidence that there is a policy, but the policy, in fact, cannot be reconstructed, cannot be found. And then it is deemed that the policy with the lowest limits that was in effect at that time would be applicable. But I think there are certain standards and hurdles that you have to get to do that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
And again, I apologize if you talked about this while I was out, but the language in on page 4, lines 30 and 34, both in both places, it refers to evidence that tends to show the policy limits. I don't know enough about these, but what would be evidence that tends to show? Would it be the amount of premium paid? Would it be comparable? What is it that would tend to show?
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Herman may have some other practical examples, but as I know enough to be dangerous on the subject, but I think it's clearly things like a canceled check, a payment to an insurance company, a policy number, evidence that perhaps a claim had been made during that period of time on a regular, normal liability kind of issue.
If I can, what this really does, though, it's evidence that tends to show the policy limits. And that's what I'm curious. What is it that would show the policy limits in the absence of a policy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, I'm not sure. And I think that there may be some reference in files to a cap, some reference in writing to the limits, but not having the actual policy itself. Reference in board minutes, we have $100,000 or $500,000 general liability policy approved by the board. Some kind of other reference to a limit.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you,
Mark. Why don't we go ahead and bring Mr. Herman back up? I think there were a couple of follow-up questions. Representative McPherson, do you recall the one that you had that we deferred?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It was about the number of insurers who are involved in the Portland Harbor Superfund site, which I thought was a question that maybe is most effectively put to the insurance industry, but since they demurred on it, I'll ask Mr. Herman that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we don't have exact numbers. As you indicate, the insurance industry is probably in a better position to respond to this, but what I can say based on having reviewed the insurance coverage for profiles for a number of entities that are involved in these kind of claims statewide is that, you know, where you're talking about a many decades long period, you're usually talking about, you know, often 5 to 10 primary insurers, another 5 to 10 excess insurers, and those are companies like, you know, there are a number of large general liability insurance companies that have written coverage in Oregon, so you're probably talking about at least certainly more than 10, maybe 20, 30 companies. I don't know. I mean, all I know is who the carriers are for the clients we represent in these things, and there tends to be a group of sort of about 10 carriers that you see recurring in these kinds of claims.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
Then out of the, you know, I realize that these are a rough guesstimate, right. But out of that rough guesstimate of numbers of insurers who are potentially involved, how many of them are actively writing policies in Oregon today?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that I don't know. I do know that the kind of coverage that we're dealing with here, pre-1986 general liability coverage, isn't being written by anyone at all in the state of Oregon today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Mr. Herman, one of the questions that seemed to at least create some confusion on the part of the committee was what the bill intended with respect to this issue. The example was given by Ms. Pulser about the 10-year coverage by Reliance, the 1-year coverage by Oregon Mutual, and how that was intended to be handled by the bill when you've got a company like Reliance that is no longer operable. Can you walk us through what the bill, in your view, would accomplish in that relationship?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There are two situations that we deal with factually that I think we need to keep in mind when sort of running through this. One is a situation in which the harm is divisible. An example that was given in some earlier work sessions was, again, you have a site at which a company in year one has a spill of petroleum hydrocarbons, and there's an insurance company that's on the hook for that year. Let's just call that one the Oregon Mutual policy. And then you have the next 9 years another contaminant, PCBs, pentachlorophenol, something completely different, distinguishable, is spilled or released over those 9 years, and that's the period that Reliance has. Where the harm is divisible, then the first carrier could only have responsibility for whatever the dollar amount would be that would be attributable to that first year of contamination, because the policy says that the claim by the policyholder can only be for property damage that occurs during the policy period. In that case, we can determine what that is pretty precisely. So in that circumstance, you would be saying that Oregon Mutual just has to pay one-tenth. In a situation where the harm isn't divisible, where you have petroleum hydrocarbon spills across the entire 10 years, then in that case, Oregon Mutual would be liable up to its policy limit because the harm isn't divisible. And otherwise, you'd have the policy holder being in a position where it would have to assume more than its fair share of the cost because the insurer had agreed to pay up to its policy limits for damage that occurred during its policy period. So if it's not divisible, the answer is then that the carrier is responsible to its policy limits. If it is divisible, which is almost never the case, then you would only attribute the damage, the divisible portion, to the carrier that was responsible for that particular year.
But again, to its policy limits.
Exactly. Always with that, subject to that limitation.
Any questions about that? Okay, and then finally, the question that I wanted to follow up with is we had a little bit of a discussion in the second panel about the issue with respect to the change in what isn't really a very defined standard in Oregon right now with respect to insurance policies and the loss policy issue, but at least the discussion of whether it's preponderance or whether it's a clear and convincing standard. Can you just comment on that issue?
The Oregon law, and this is as Ms. Pulser said. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The Oregon law, as Ms. Pulser said, on this issue is being debated in front of the Oregon Court of Appeals in the Schnitzer case. But the current state of Oregon law is that the standard is, in civil cases, is preponderance of the evidence. There are only two exceptions to that, neither of which under current Oregon law applies to insurance policies. So the position that policyholders take and is that the current state of Oregon law is that the rule is preponderance of the evidence where you're dealing with a missing insurance policy because it is, in effect, a contract, and the Oregon rule on the standard that applies to missing or lost contracts is preponderance of the evidence. And we would be willing to share citations to that with the committee if that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on your question.
You may.
But hearing what the opponent said, it appears that the trial court has taken a position contrary to what may be the standard, and they're applying for whatever reason, clear and convincing. And if that's the case, what was the rationale or reasoning that the trial court gave for using the higher standard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I'm not in a position to answer that question. I'm not trial counsel in that case. Trial counsel in that case is here, if she might speak to that.
My name is Joan Snyder. I'm an attorney with Stoll Reeves, and I'm here on behalf of Snitzer today. And that is a case that Snitzer has on appeal, and the trial court didn't give a rationale. He said he thought there should be a higher standard of proof. He also said that whatever the standard of proof was, he would have decided there was not sufficient evidence. So it's not actually clear that that issue will be decided by the court. He suggested to the court that they try to resolve it on appeal, but it's not necessary, so it's not clear there will be a decision.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to, Mr. Gallagher, did you want to comment on the Dash 5 amendments?
Mr. Chair, if I have them. I think, Mr. Chair, the issue here is what happens if you have someone with a policy where they self-insured for a certain amount, a very high amount, and had an excess insurance policy on top of it? Were they self-insured or were they uninsured? The way to clarify that is if somebody didn't purchase general liability insurance at all, then they are there and they would share in the allocation of the risk. I would like to correct one other thing that I said. I was reminded by counsel that Snitzer is not a member of the Willamette cleanup group. They are an admitted PRP. They just chose not to join that group.
Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummell.
I just want to make sure that I understood correctly what trial counsel had said. You said that the court said that the proof should be higher than what it is in the statute, but that irrespective of what it was that the evidence was not sufficient to meet either standard preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing evidence. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, that's correct. What he said is that based on the evidence that was presented, he didn't think that the policyholder had established the policy either by preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing. And so he said, relatively sort of gratuitously in that context, that he thought the standard should be clear and convincing, but if the Court of Appeals disagreed with him, he still didn't think there was enough evidence. So it has now gone up to the Court of Appeals on the question of whether there's sufficient evidence, and the Court of Appeals doesn't actually have to decide the standard question because they could find that there isn't evidence either way, which is what he said, or they could adopt one or the other.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
May.
Is the standard actually explicit in the statute? Does it say preponderance or which does it say?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, the general rule in Oregon is to prove a contract, you prove it by preponderance of the evidence. Through our case law, we have established basically two exceptions for when you have a higher standard of proof. One of them involves when there's criminal liability, and therefore we care much more greatly or if there's something that's akin to criminal liability. The other is in the case, and I could get more information on this, and I can get it for you by tomorrow, but it has to do with deeds. When we have an instrument of trust that's conveying property where it is subject to forgery, so it's deeds and wills, and it's a very narrow exception, then in those cases, we apply the higher standard of clear and convincing. But it doesn't apply to bank instruments and some of the other things that I heard the other panel discussing. But I can actually provide follow-up to that, and we did provide some follow-up to Bill Joseph, giving him the briefing on that so he could see both sides of that point before.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, while you're all there, in case there's another question, but I want to bring up Ms. Foggin again. Apparently, she had a comment on the Dash 5 amendments, and while I get you up there, Tom, I think it would be helpful to get her comment on that. I know you have flown in for today's hearing. Is that right, Ms. Foggin?
It is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
appreciate that.
You're going to try to get back out of town when this is over.
Wouldn't mind staying a little bit.
I blame you. We're trying to get out of town, too.
Well, I missed it, Kremel. What'd you say?
I said, I don't blame her. We're trying to get out of town, too. That's a
problem. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and representatives of the committee, with respect to the proposed amendment, it injects in my mind an uncertainty in that it proposes to delete the words self-insured or and uninsured and insert instead otherwise without a general liability insurance policy in the provisions relating to the circumstances under which a policyholder would have responsibility for a share in an allocation dispute. And there could well be many circumstances where a policyholder has a general liability policy, but that policy does not respond to this particular claim. For example, it contains an exclusion, or it's limited to certain sites or locations. And therefore, this appears to improperly narrow the circumstances where a policyholder would be responsible for a share. And the prior language referencing uninsured might have included those circumstances where the insurance policy was there, but it did not respond.
Okay. Counsel. Pam, do you have any suggested language?
I would work on some and be prepared to propose it. I don't have it right at this very moment, but I think including the word uninsured or perhaps saying otherwise without a general liability insurance policy that responded during those years, something or under which coverage existed, something to that effect. The point being the existence of the policy alone isn't enough to take care of that dollar share. It has to be a policy that will pay for it.
Representative Sherry.
Or could you address something like uninsured portion of the loss? That seems to me to address the circumstance where you would have coverage, but for some reason or another there may not be coverage for all of the loss. Then that would take into account that uninsured portion.
Tom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Chevalier, there's no disagreement on what you said. It's only a matter of wording,
yeah.
And we would welcome their language. We would look at that.
Okay. Well, anything else for this group committee? All right. I appreciate your time. I think we've convinced the non-lawyer members of the committee that they're going to give up their interest in ever seeking a law degree based on today's hearing, because this is a lot what it's like.
The nitty gritty.
Yeah.
I didn't take this class.
But
this isn't at all what we see on LA law, Mr. Chair.
But thank you very much for the instructive hearing. It would be the chair's intention. We're going to meet again tomorrow. I don't anticipate this bill being on for work session tomorrow. We will meet again on Thursday. There is some possibility that Thursday will be this committee's last official day of hearing. So we will have another meeting on Thursday. This bill could be back up for work session discussion on Thursday. So committee, you should sort of be thinking about the bill and doing your homework. And I think we'll have three or four bills that will be sort of wrap-up bills on tomorrow's agenda as well, if you'd prepare accordingly. Thank you very much, committee, and thank you all of you. We're adjourned.